The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Double September-October 2020 issue. We begin today with our feature story, Robots Save the Day. If you find yourself in a disaster, it might be machines that come to your rescue. Imagine you're trapped in the wreckage of a collapsed building. Unable to move underneath the debris, you're forced to wait, hoping a first responder will soon pull you from the rubble. Finally, something peeks through the tangle of concrete and steel, and you find yourself face to face with a robot? We have to contend with our fair share of disasters on our little blue planet. These calamities can range from extreme weather events like hurricanes to other naturally occurring phenomena such as earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. Sometimes, as with explosions and bombings, the destruction is intentional, whereas in the case of nuclear accidents, mining disasters, and most wildfires, it's simply the unfortunate side effect of human activities. Regardless of the cause, for centuries, humans have set out on search and rescue missions to save those left in a disaster's wake. But in the past few decades, robots have taken an increasingly active role in these rescue efforts. Bots have battled their way through major events like the World Trade Center attacks, Hurricanes Katrina and Harvey, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, and the eruption of Hawaii's Kilauea volcano. These mechanical saviors can range from ground to marine to aerial vehicles, including drones that don't just rummage through rubble for survivors, but provide reconnaissance from above. Beyond that, roboticists across the globe are building new, inventive types of rescue robots. Many projects still in development draw inspiration from the animal kingdom, mimicking designs that nature has perfected to make machines that can move through harsh environments, from droids that resemble snakes and cockroaches to a fleet of autonomous bees. And while many are still years away from being used in actual crises, they point towards a future in which, contrary to much of science fiction, where bots bring death and destruction, it's the robots that come to our rescue. Scientists began suggesting the idea of using robots for search and rescue operations in the 1980s. They were driven by the prospect of bots that could operate in a range of environments, from underground tunnels to volcanic craters to the twisted maze of concrete created when buildings collapse. In short, they wanted robots that could go to places that are unreachable or simply too dangerous for human rescuers. That just seemed to be a go-to application in robotics, says roboticist Robin Murphy, director of the Humanitarian Robotics and AI Laboratory at Texas A&M University. But these ideas didn't gain much traction at the time, partly because the robots weren't advanced enough yet to do the tasks being proposed. Then, in 1995, at opposite ends of the globe, two major events made scientists take the promise of disaster robotics much more seriously: the Oklahoma City bombing and the Hanshin Awaji earthquake in Kobe, Japan. The former reduced a significant chunk of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building to rubble and killed 168 people. The latter was among the worst quakes in Japan's history, killing an estimated 6,400 and damaging or destroying nearly 400,000 buildings. In both instances, says Murphy, the difficulty of digging through collapsed buildings made it nearly impossible to reach those confined within. There were most likely survivors trapped within the deep recesses, she says, and you just couldn't get to them in time. Meanwhile, roboticists across the world are working to make more agile robots that could operate in extreme environments. With those two catastrophes as catalysts, the notion of search and rescue robots shifted from an abstract idea into the domain of applied research. In the U.S., those efforts were led by Murphy, while in Japan, they were spearheaded by the roboticist Satoshi Tadokoro, Together, they are considered the founders of the field of disaster robotics. The Japanese had been working on large robots, says Murphy. They wanted big robots to rapidly remove rubble. In the U.S., on the other hand, the emphasis was on building smaller robots to first locate people who were trapped within collapsed structures and then figure out how to get to them. Both approaches were very measured, with safe engineering practices, she adds, but they were two different approaches. Rescue robots were deployed for the first time after the attacks on the World Trade Center on the morning of September 11, 2001. By 4 p.m. that day, a team of roboticists from Washington, D.C., led by Lieutenant Colonel John Blitch of the U.S. Army, founder of the Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue, had arrived on the scene. At the time, the jet fuel that set the towers ablaze was still burning. There were places where it was like an oven, says Murphy. Then an engineering professor at the University of South Florida, who led a separate robotics team. Her research group had already been ready and waiting to deploy robots for a crisis for a year prior. Murphy and three graduate students jumped in the car as soon as they got word of the attack, bringing small wheeled robots equipped with headlights and cameras and connected to a tether. The advantage of a robot was to be able to go into places people and dogs couldn't, and do things they can't do, says Murphy. But getting robots into these places wasn't always easy. At the World Trade Center site, the scientists quickly realized that they often needed to climb ladders and clamber over debris before they could deploy their robots in these deep recesses. In some cases, the bots had to be carried in backpacks up to half a mile from the staging area. While these robots couldn't find any survivors after 9/11, they provided invaluable feedback for the researchers under real-time conditions. We began to see that a smaller robot is indeed better, says Murphy. They also learned that when first responders are working with robots in a chaotic, unstructured environment, two heads are better than one. You don't know which way is up. You've lost depth perception. It's dark, you're under a lot of stress, and you're looking at a small screen, says Murphy. All of these things make it very easy to have errors. But if you have a second person and you're both talking aloud, your performance improves dramatically. In a 2004 study co-authored by Murphy, researchers found that roboticists who talked more with their teammates were 9 times more likely to find survivors in search and rescue drills. In the years since 9/11, Murphy, the longtime director of the Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue, now the Humanitarian Robotics and AI Laboratory, has helped deploy robots in response to nearly 30 disasters. When Hurricane Katrina slammed into the Gulf Coast in 2005, Murphy and her team were dispatched to Mississippi, where they used drones to chart the scope of the storm's devastation. This was such a clear win, she says. You can see things immediately. You have this great feedback loop where you can see the extent of the disaster and see the flooding. Over a decade later, in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, which unloaded an estimated 27 trillion gallons of rainwater on Texas and Louisiana over 6 days, Murphy and her team used drones to provide a tactical view from above. The drones were tasked with mapping out the best routes for deploying rescue boats to pluck people from their flooded homes. They had the ability to immediately see how deep the water was in these different parts of neighborhoods, so they could estimate how bad the recovery was going to be, says Murphy. Plus, adds Murphy, there are significant economic benefits that come with this type of aerial recon during disasters. In one instance after Hurricane Harvey, the Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue sent drones underneath a closed bridge to assess the extent of the water damage, and they found that it was safe to reopen for the public. That was a major commuter route, says Murphy. People could not get back to work until the bridge was open. And yet, when most people think of search and rescue, images of people dangling from helicopters or in the arms of a first responder might pop into our minds. How many lives do these robots actually save? That's like asking how many lives has a fire truck saved, says Murphy. The robots don't go in and pull anybody out. People pull people out. But Murphy also points to a moment during the refugee crisis in Greece, during which thousands of people, many fleeing violence in their own countries, tried to cross the Mediterranean and reach the country's mainland by boat. At one point in 2016, a boat full of people became trapped against rocky shores, where the tall cliffs and high seas made it impossible for the Hellenic Coast Guard to reach them. First responders used a remote-controlled surfboard-like vessel called EMILY, short for Emergency Integrated Life-Saving Lanyard, as a flotation device to ferry people to safety. They saved 26 people that way, says Murphy. The field of disaster robotics isn't just limited to modified vehicles that roll on the ground or scout the skies. Today, scientists worldwide are tapping into the natural processes of plants and animals to build a better class of robot, many of which have the potential applications in search and rescue. And while some of these bio-inspired bots are still confined to the lab, at least one has been tested during an actual disaster. On September 19, 2017, a devastating 7.1 magnitude earthquake shook central Mexico. The earthquake's epicenter, near the city of San Juan Reboso, was just 75 miles from Mexico City. It would result in nearly 370 deaths and damage more than 44,000 buildings, including many collapsed structures in the capital city. The next day, volunteers with Cruz Roja Mexicana, the Mexican Red Cross, asked roboticists from the Carnegie Mellon University Biorobotics Laboratory to bring their biologically inspired machines, specifically their snake robots, from Pittsburgh to Mexico City to aid in the recovery efforts. It was a little bit surreal, says systems scientist Matthew Travers, co-director of the Biorobotics Lab. For several days afterwards, Travers, alongside researcher Nico Zavios and graduate student Julian Whitman, rode in an ambulance with first responders as they traveled between the city's collapsed buildings. With only a gas generator as a power source, they used the cameras on the heads of the modular skinny robots to peer into a building's open spaces and confirm that nobody was trapped inside. For the past 20 years, scientists at the Carnegie Mellon Lab have worked to develop snake robots. By tweaking previous robotics designs, they created a unified snake robot, or U-Snake, made up of a series of identical jointed modules that allow the bot's body to take on a variety of shapes to move through different types of terrain. While the U-Snake has been lengthened to include as many as 36 modules, the version deployed in Mexico City only had 16, making the robot much easier to control. If you draw a circle in the air with your hand, your elbow and shoulder and wrist are all going to do the right things, so you can draw that perfect circle, says Howie Choset, a robotics professor at Carnegie Mellon and co-director of the Biorobotics Lab. The more joints you have and the more degrees of freedom you have, the more difficult that problem of coordination becomes. But snakes, why did it have to be snakes? In short, says Choset, snakes were a perfect model because their unique shape and range of motion allow them to thread through tightly packed spaces, like a collapsed building. If you use search and rescue as an example, you now have a tool that a rescue worker can use to essentially extend his sensory reach, says Choset. It's a horrible situation in a collapsed building. The rescue worker wants to find the survivor, and it's hard to get at them. With the advantage of the snake robot's dexterity, he continues, it could potentially poke through debris to communicate with survivors. That sort of parallels what snakes are good at, says Choset, because early on in their evolution, they were burrowing animals. Travers and Choset acknowledged that the snake robots had somewhat limited success in the aftermath of the Mexico City earthquake. It wasn't like we brought the snake robot down there and we won the war, says Travers. Because the robot's camera had not been updated in a while, the video quality was poor. In addition, it was not equipped with any microphones, speakers, proximity sensors, or thermal imaging, all features that would have boosted the U-Snake's ability to communicate with victims or map the environment. The reason why we don't have more features is solely because of money, says Choset. Research on snake robots continues to slither along. In February, roboticists from Johns Hopkins University published a paper saying that their snake robot moved faster than most previous designs, even approaching the speed of their biological counterparts. Yet despite recent advances like these, adds Choset, it remains a challenge to get funding to develop search and rescue robots. While snakes are a prime example of bio-inspiration for roboticists looking to mimic nature's designs, the idea of building machines that draw inspiration from animals is hardly new. Starting in the late 15th century, for example, Leonardo da Vinci modeled his designs for a flying machine based on the wings of a bird or a bat. In the last 20 to 30 years, there's definitely been more engineers trying to look at biological organisms for inspiration, says Kaushik Jayaram, assistant professor of robotics at the University of Colorado Boulder. Part of it is maybe just that we know a lot more about biology so we can actually understand how animals move. Jayaram is no stranger to the science of animal locomotion. While working as a research assistant at the University of California, Berkeley, he led a study published in 2016 to better understand how the Paraplaneta americana, or the American cockroach, is able to squeeze through tiny cracks and crevices so swiftly. It turns out they're able to squish their exoskeletons by more than half and compress themselves from a standing height of around 15 millimeters to a mere 3 millimeters, which is roughly the size of two stacked pennies, says Jayaram. They're able to do this in less than a second, and even when the creepy critters are squeezing through small gaps, they can still move at speeds of around 5 body lengths a second. Scaled up to human size, says Jayaram, that's around the same speed as Usain Bolt's world record. As part of the same study, the research team was then inspired to create a soft, palm-sized robot that splays its legs sideways when flattened, allowing it to quickly squish through tight spaces half its height. Dubbed CRAM, or Compressible Robot with Articulated Mechanisms, the robot was topped with a plastic shield similar to a cockroach's exoskeleton, allowing it to move quickly through confined spaces. The scientists say the robot could be used to move through rubble in the aftermath of tornadoes, earthquakes, or explosions. These kinds of robots would be deployed in swarms, says Jayaram. I envision them crawling over these highly unstructured environments and trying to find signs of life using sensors. Other researchers have suggested sending out swarms of insect-inspired robots for disaster relief, too. At Harvard University, roboticist and engineering professor Robert Wood has been developing robo-bees, tiny flying robots with a wingspan roughly the size of a half-dollar coin. In 2019, one of the robo-bees took to the skies in its first solo mission without the use of a power cord, becoming the lightest vehicle ever to attain continuous untethered flight. We know these robots to be small, agile, and fast, meaning that they could potentially get into the nooks and crannies of collapsed structures, says Wood. Ideally, these things would be very low cost. Instead of having one all-powerful robot, maybe you could have thousands of these little things, and maybe most of them fail, but you get more robust coverage if you have large numbers. Wood says that he could envision rescue workers carrying a kit, much like a laptop case, that opens up to deploy a fleet of robo-bees to survey a certain area, returning periodically to share any data. But he also acknowledges that he's still far from achieving that vision, which may take anywhere from 10 to 20 years to become a reality. However long it takes for robots to be more widely used in disasters, they might have to overcome some anti-automation bias in the process. According to a 2017 survey in the Pew Research Center, more than 70% of Americans are worried about a future where robots and computers can do jobs currently done by humans. But scientists like Travers think rescue robots could fundamentally change how we think about machines. If you're trapped in a building during a flood and a robot finds you, it's going to change your perspective, he says. Once it becomes crystal clear that automation and technology is helping more than it's hurting, that shift will start to happen. An athletic evolution. To uncover the habits of ancient humans, scientists are studying modern sports stars. Archaeologist Anamike Milks planned to test the ballistic properties of some of the world's oldest spears. Crafted by Neanderthals 300,000 years ago, the wooden artifacts measure about 7 feet long and resemble oversized broomsticks with sharpened tips. When discovered in the 1990s at a site in Schöningen, Germany, they rested alongside the butchered remains of 35 horses. Apparently, Neanderthals, armed with the spears, had some very successful hunts. But just how far and fast could these ancient weapons soar? Milks wanted the answers, so she commissioned a woodworker to carve replicas from dense spruce. Yet to do the experiment right, Milks needed study participants who could throw like their lives depended on it. Neanderthals were, after all, hunter-gatherers, who killed their daily meals with spears and other primitive technology. Put a spear into the hands of most people today, and they'd go hungry. The main issue was just trying to get beyond the total lack of skill in throwing, says Milks, a researcher at University College London. Earlier studies tested inexperienced throwers, sometimes the scientists themselves, and concluded that spears could only sail a couple of dozen feet, feebly. I raised my eyebrows, she recalls. As part of research published in 2018 in Scientific Reports, Milks put six javelin athletes to the test. The trained throwers launched Schoeningen spear replicas over 35 miles per hour and more than 80 feet. By using athletes as study subjects, Milks added fresh data to an old debate. Scholars have long argued that Neanderthal weapons were too hefty to hurl, and therefore they had to be thrust directly into prey. Compared with throwing from afar, this jabbing technique would have been high risk, low return, and could have played a role in Neanderthals' eventual extinction. But in the hands of an expert, you see quite a different perspective, she says. The spears perform well. They fly. Milks is not the only scientist enlisting athletes to answer questions about human evolution. Her experiment substituted javelin throwers for spear hunters. Other recent studies have used runners to approximate ancient foragers and subbed in rowers for early farmers. With intense training regimens, athletes face physical demands more akin to our highly active ancestors. And some athletes push themselves to the extremes, allowing researchers to study the human body in survival mode. The emerging line of research offers huge potential in terms of looking into and exploring our evolutionary journey, says Danny Longman, a physiologist at Loughborough University in the UK. Naming the approach Human Athletic Paleobiology in a 2020 paper in the Yearbook of Physical Anthropology, Longman and colleagues outline ways that it has shed new light on the human species and could continue to do so. About a decade ago, article co-author Jay Stock started analyzing athletes, specifically CT scans of their bones. An anthropology professor, then at the University of Cambridge and now at the University of Western Ontario, Stock wanted to identify skeletal features related to exercise, which he could also find on ancient bones. He could help clarify the physical demands of past societies, how much running, throwing, and hauling the average person did thousands of years ago or more. At the time, it was known that intense, repeated actions alter bone properties, such as thickness, shape, and density. When you habitually work a bone in a certain manner, it toughens up to counteract the strains. The pattern of bone alterations across the skeleton depends on the particular activities undertaken. But to understand these patterns, Stock needed a key: measurements of bones subjected to known exercise regimens. Everyday folks wouldn't suffice. Most people in industrialized societies are couch potatoes compared with ancient people. And reasonably active individuals partake in a variety of sports, so their bones are not representative of any one particular act. That's why Stock turned to athletes. If they're trained for the same sport, and they've trained for a long period of time, particularly during adolescence, then they're likely to have stereotypical activity patterns, he says. In preliminary studies, Stock and collaborator Colin Shaw found consistent skeletal differences between university swimmers, runners, cricketers, and field hockey players. Extending the methods to fossils, their 2013 Journal of Human Evolution paper reported similarities between bones of modern swimmers and late 1800s Andaman Islanders, who canoed and swam to forage their meals, and the shins of Homo sapiens and Neanderthals between 40,000 and 120,000 years old appeared even more reinforced than those of cross-country athletes who have run 80 to 100 miles a week since adolescence. The implication? These early humans traveled far and wide in pursuit of daily needs. More recently, the approach revealed the hard work of Central Europe's early farming women. It seems their daily grind, 2 to 7,000 years ago, was as strenuous as the training of elite female athletes today. For a 2017 Science Advances study, Stock's then-graduate student Allison Murray compared bone strength among 30 Neolithic women and present-day runners, soccer players, rowers, and non-athletes. On average, the farmers' lower leg bones were similar to today's non-athletes, suggesting the past women generally stuck close to home. But the big finding was, whoa, when you look at their arms, they were much stronger than even the rowers, says Murray, now an anthropologist at the University of Victoria in Canada. These rowers trained up to 21 hours each week, pulling strokes with force over six times their body weight. Yet the farming women developed hardier upper arms, likely from planting and harvesting crops, grinding grain, and crafting pottery. Low intensity, but just over and over activity, says Murray. Beyond the labors of past populations, Murray and others are using athletes to investigate more fundamental questions about human evolution. During times of stress and scarcity, how did our ancestors survive? It's theorized that humans have evolved coping mechanisms. When resources were depleted, hormones tell the body to channel energy to the most important tasks, immune defense and upkeep of vital organs, and away from non-urgent matters like sex and growth. However, the details of this process are unknown and problematic to research. Obviously, it's unethical to starve or overexert study participants. But some people already push their bodies to the brink. Ultra-endurance athletes compete in races lasting days or weeks, covering hundreds of miles by foot, bike, rowboat, or other means of self-propulsion. Scientists have tracked changes in these athletes' hormones, immune markers, and reserves of muscle and fat across the grueling competitions. Potentially, that can tell us something about the physiology and endocrinology of way, way long-dead ancestors, says Murray. These are the types of questions that I just never thought I'd be able to ask, only working with bones. Murray and Longman recently collected spit and blood samples from runners in races 3 to 6 times the distance of a marathon, and in extreme climates. Two of the competitions, in Spain and the Peruvian jungle, saw temperatures near 100 degrees. Others, in the Himalayas of Nepal and within the Arctic Circle of Finland, were well below freezing. Analysis of these samples is underway, and the researchers are eager for the results. They already have proof of concept, evidence that ultra-endurance events do, in fact, cause bodies to enter survival mode. In a 2018 American Journal of Human Biology paper, Longman, Stock, and colleagues evaluated 66 runners who finished a continuous 102.6-mile race in 22 to 36 hours. Post-race athletes showed a boost of immune markers coincident with decreased testosterone and sexual desire, the latter based on self-reported arousal scores when viewing a slideshow of semi-nude figures. This fits theoretical predictions that, when the going gets tough, immune defenses are prioritized over libido. Their bodies have to make decisions about how to allocate energy, says Stock. That, to me, is really, really interesting because it's a window into survival. A window opened by athletes pushing the limits of the human species. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.